わすればよ。オムナモバグバテワスレマヤ。オムナモバグバテワスレマヤ。So we're reading from Canto 10, chapter 61, verse number 6. Chapter is entitled Lord Balaram slays Rukmi. Sorry. Padyut gama sanavarara napara socha. Padyut gama sanavarara napara socha. Tambula Vishramana Vijana Gandamalyai Tambula Vishramana Vijana Gandamalyai Kesha Pashara Shayanasna Panupahayai Kesha Pashara Shayanasna Panupahayai
Kesha Pashara Shayanasna Panupahayai
Dasi Satapi Vibho Vidaru Smadasham
Dasi Satapi Vibho Vidaru Smadasham
Dasi Satapi Vibho Vidaru Smadasham By approaching asana, offering a seat, vara, first class, ahana, worship, para, his feet, shocha, washing, tambula, offering betel nut, vishramana, helping him to relax by massaging his feet. Vijana, fanning. Ganda, offering fragrant substances. Malyai, and flower garlands. Kesha, his hair. Prasara, by dressing. Shayana, arranging his bed. Snapana, bathing him. Upahaya, and by presenting gifts. Dasi, maidservants. Shataha, having hundreds. Api, although. Viboho, for the Almighty Lord. Vidadusma, they executed. Dasyam, service. Translation. Although the Supreme Lord's queens each had hundreds of maidservants, they chose to personally serve the Lord by approaching him humbly, offering him a seat, worshipping him with excellent paraphernalia, bathing and massaging his feet, giving him pan to chew, fanning him, anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste, adorning him with flower garlands, dressing his hair, arranging his bed, bathing him and presenting him with various gifts. Shall we repeat that all responsively? Fair bit, but anyway. Although the Supreme Lord's queens each had hundreds of maidservants, they chose to personally serve the Lord By approaching him humbly.
By approaching him humbly.
Offering him a seat.
Worshipping him with excellent paraphernalia.
Bathing and massaging his feet.
Giving him pan to chew.
Fanning him. Anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste.
Adorning him with flower garlands.
Dressing his hair.
Arranging his bed.
Bathing him. And presenting him with various gifts.
Purport.
Srila Sridhar Swami explains that Sukadev Goswami is so eager to describe these glorious pastimes of the Lord with his queens that he has repeated these verses. That is, text 5 of this chapter is almost identical with text 44 of the 59th chapter in this canto. And text 6 is identical with text 45 of that chapter. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti explains that the term Vararana, excellent offerings, indicates that the queens offered the Lord palmfuls of flowers, Pushpanjali, and palmfuls of jewels, Ratnanjali.
So
in this verse, we hear further descriptions of these loving exchanges and offerings between the queens and the Lord, or which are the queens making to the Lord. And very easily, from the whole list of offerings, we can nicely understand that actually, ultimately, we are offering the same things now to the deities. It is exactly, describe the deity worship, basically. So we are supposed to approach him humbly in offering him a seat. We do that every time we offer the boga. We actually put a mat there and we ask the Lord to take his seat on the mat. And we worship him with excellent paraphernalia, offering all kinds of nice things, bathing him, we do that every morning, massaging his feet, we also do that with oils. We actually massage the body of the Lord before he gets bathed. Giving him pan to chew, we might not be doing that here, but I know in Bangladesh they do. They offer him pan. Once they were asking me what to do with the maha, So, and fanning him, we certainly do that. Anointing him with fragrant sandalwood paste, we also do that. Adorning him with flower garlands every day. Dressing his hair, arranging his bed, bathing him, and presenting him with various gifts. All these are items which we are already doing now in the deity worship. So, we can clearly understand this is not simply just some ritualistic offering we are doing when we offer all these items, when we offer aarti, when we offer the chamra. We're actually chasing the flies and the mosquitoes away when we offer the chamra. That's the purpose of it. And the fan, we offer some cooling air. So these are not just some ritualistic things, but actually this is a very personal service, very personal offering. And when you visit places like Bangladesh, these things are still going on there amongst the devotees. It's actually quite amazing, very, very sweet, very cultured. Like, for example, if you're invited somewhere for prasadam, so same thing, the host receives you humbly, offers you a seat. Then the first thing is they bring a bowl and some washing water for their hands. So you just wash your right hand. And then that gets taken away. And then all the different items come in a certain order. And they just put a little bit on your plate and then a little bit more. And the host never sits down with a guest and eats. This is completely uncultured.
you know, the host just simply serves. And at the very end, if there's something left, then he will take that. And sometimes it's like that, that there's nothing much left. I've been to some lunch programs, you know, because usually there's so many devotees coming, 10, 20 devotees coming for lunch. So, and sometimes it's like that, that there's only the dry rice left. And the host happily sits down and eats the dry rice and maybe a little bit of dal, and that's it. And all the preparation, that's usually about 10 different sabjis and so many things they bring out, you know. And then, and just you can take a little bit of everything, you know. So even though there might be 20 devotees coming, they just have one bowl, you know, medium-sized bowl of each sabji, and maybe one is in a bigger bowl. But you just take a little bit of everything because there's so many items. You know, your plate is full, you know, you can hardly manage. So, and then very often, I've seen this, you know, there's really for the host, there's nothing left. So that's why the host would never sit down and eat, because he would feel so, or she would feel so bad to eat before the guests are actually fully satisfied. And there's always that anxiety, there may be, I don't have enough. And this is the biggest embarrassment and, oh, because shame on the host if he hasn't got enough to satisfy the guests, if the guest asks for something which he hasn't got. Oh my God, you know, this is really a painful situation for a host. So that's why a host would never sit down before the guests are fully satisfied, and only then afterwards he accepts something. So, and then after you have eaten, then very often they offer you a place to rest. They just take you, you know, they just... Usually there's in each room there's these big double beds, and usually in one double bed at night the whole family sleeps, you know. Husband, wife, two, three kids, they're all lined up in the bed. So and then during the day the big bed serves as a sitting place for the guests. So often when we visit a place they don't have necessarily, I mean the very wealthy places they have a large lounge room with a lounge arrangement there, but very often in the simple places, the bed at the same time serves as a sitting place. So when you go to a simple place, then they offer you the big bed, and all the devotees sit in a semicircle on the bed. So, and then the whole social life goes on there, you know. So actually bedrooms in one sense are a little bit of a waste of time, you know, because during the day you can't use them for anything. So the more, you know, simple living arrangements, they don't have a bedroom as such, you know. So, and then, all right, then they offer you a place to rest, and very often they actually stand there and fan you, you know, because it's so hot. And many places, they don't have electric fans. Of course, now many places do have electric fans. But many places don't. Many places in the villages don't even have electricity. So actually somebody stands there and fans you. Or they offer you some sandalwood pulp. Sometimes they offer you a garland. So actually all these items, they're also offering a guest, you know, in a very, very sweet and cultured way. And also I remember, you know, if you, for example, arrive on a bigger program, they also have a very, very cultured reception for the guest and the main speakers or something, you know, which really it reminds you nearly at the descriptions of Krishna entering Dwarka or something, you know. There's all the people lined up and they were throwing flower petals and they sprinkle scented water in front of you where you're going. And of course, there's chanting there and the conscious blowing. You know, actually, even when you enter a house, you know, then they get the, for lunch program, they get the conch out and blow the conch to receive you. Yeah, these things are all going on, you know, very, very nice. There's a whole culture there, you know. Also, when you arrive at a program, the conch is blowing, somebody walks along with you, blows constantly the conch, you know, auspicious sound. And the ladies, they make these ululu noises, you know. I can't do it, but, you know, at any time and occasion, they're doing this ululu, you know. And it's also one of the auspicious sounds. Yeah, and then the scented water sprinkled, the petals are thrown, and also there's young dressed up ladies. They're going along with you, you know, that's also one of the auspicious items of reception. Young unmarried girls, which are beautifully dressed, and they carry some flower arrangements. I remember once I went to a program and they had flower arrangements in the letters of welcome, W-E-L-C-O-M-E. They had some flower arrangements. Every girl was having one flower arrangement in one letter. You know, like that they're welcoming you. So very, very nice, very sweet, very respectful, very cultured. So all these things are still going on in those places where that culture is still there. Also another thing I once was watching a couple of years ago, I was taking one Mataji from Ukraine to Bangladesh with her 10-year-old son. Usually I like to invite people and take them along because it is just such a unique experience. So, and this young boy, 10 years old, everybody really was charmed by him and everybody loved him so much. And then in the morning when the devotees were taking bath, we were in a village and we were doing a program there. So very often there's no bathrooms and you just take bath on the pump. So and then this boy, Achuta was his name, he was taking bath. And then all the brahmacharis, they came and they bathed him. They took a jug and poured water over him. And it was so I watched it from far away, you know, and it looked so sweet, so charming, you know, because it was like a loving exchange. They liked him so much and they just wanted to bathe him, you know. And just, they all had fun there, you know, just bathing that boy, you know. So in that way, you know, and seeing that, I was thinking, yes, this is what it must have been like when Krishna was on the planet. Actually, people derived great pleasure from bathing him. You know, it was a very loving and charming way to interact with him, you know. So and the same thing they were doing with that boy, you know, and I was thinking, this is actually so nice, you know. And also I've had this experience myself when I'm in some place somewhere taking bath, then usually the ladies, they come and they want to assist you. And for us Westerners, it's a little unusual, you know, because you kind of feel like saying, oh, it's all right, you know, I manage, don't worry, you know. And you kind of used to take bath by yourself, you know. But there were all the ladies from the house, they were all coming, you know, passing me the soap and making sure the water is warm and mixing it. And they were all there wanting to assist, you know. So, yeah, so in that way, these things are all still actually going on. Unfortunately, not so much in our Western culture. But when you visit these places where there is still some little bit of Vaishnava culture there, then all these offerings we are offering to the deities, they actually become alive. They become alive. You realize, yes, it is a loving exchange. It is not just some mechanical ritual, you know, which we sometimes might be getting into that mood, you know, just offering the arti, okay, you know, four times, two times, three times, we count the circles and we just do it like some ritual, you know. But actually, it's a very personal and loving exchange there. So, and in one of the purports in the third canto, Prabhupada is describing in which mood one should be serving a husband or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I thought that matches very nicely to today's verse. So Prabhupada says there, these are two important processes in serving the husband or the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vishrambena means with intimacy, and Gauravena means with great reverence. So these two aspects of intimacy and great reverence, they have to be present whenever we serve, husband or Supreme Personality of Godhead, or actually any other devotee as well. So when we hear that intimacy and reverence, we might think, oh, isn't that contradicting a little bit? But actually it doesn't contradict itself at all, because we clearly have to understand, in order to serve a person with intimacy, there has to be some reverence there. There has to be some respect there. Otherwise, very easily we become over familiar. And this is a very big danger, actually, this over familiarity in any kind of relationship, in any kind of exchange or exchange of service or whatever. So in order to avoid over familiarity, there has to be reverence there, absolutely necessary. And intimacy is only there if there is no over familiarity. Otherwise, no real intimacy. So in other words, in order to create intimacy within a relationship, we have to avoid over familiarity. And in order to be able to avoid over familiarity, there has to be reverence, there has to be respect. So this is very important to understand, that reverence and respect is the basis for any kind of intimate relationship. And this is something we often in the Western world we don't realize, and we think respect and reverence will create formality. And we try to create intimacy, but in actuality what we do is we create over familiarity, and we mistake that to be intimacy. Just patting somebody on the back, hey, Hari Bol, how's it going? You know, we think this is a really intimate relationship, but it's actually not. It's over familiarity. That's all it is. So, you know, especially because I'm visiting these places like Bangladesh regularly, I realize I have this practical experience, you know, that we in the Western world, we actually don't know what is true intimacy, what is true respect. Because people, actually I once heard that in a lecture too, you can say the more west you go, let's say from India, starting off from India, the more west you go, the less people are inclined to pay respect. And it's really a fact. It's really like that, you know. Like, for example, I go regularly to Ukraine too. So that's a little bit more west from India. But still, there people have that culture of respect coming truly from the heart, not being such just an external show and a formality, but actually truly being respectful. But then when you go further west, Germany, America, the more west you go, the least people are inclined to be respectful. And actually one devotee was telling me that, one Ukrainian devotee was telling me that when he was visiting America, that he was shocked how disrespectful the general devotees were often treating the Maharajas. You know, often it's just the fashion, you don't even put Maharaj or Swami on the name anymore. You just say, oh, you know, whatever, Kadambakana, you know. You don't say the Swami anymore. You know, you try to be really casual and friendly. Maybe not to the person's face, but amongst the devotees, you know. And then even when Maharajas come, there's no nice welcome, there's no, you know, nice reception, not nice eager service attitude and awe and reverence, you know, and often people don't even come to the class, or he's just such and such and so on, you know. So it's just very disrespectful in one sense, you know. And this is basically because the whole culture, the more we go to the West, the more, you know, we go to the West, the more that mood is there, that respect is no need. It's simply formality. It's simply some external thing. Let's just be really chummy with each other, you know. But that, all that creates is over familiarity. And certainly not intimacy. Absolutely not. So in order to actually have intimate and nice relationships, this respectful mood is very, very important, because really over familiarity just destroys anything, every relationship. Doesn't matter in which relationship it is, between, you know, brahmacharis or brahmacharinis in the ashram, or between husband and wife, or just amongst us general devotees towards senior devotees, junior devotees, definitely in the relationship towards guru. Over familiarity, oh, it destroys everything. It leads to guru aparat, and, you know, relationship is finished, basically, you know, if that element of over familiarity creeps in. And very easily it creeps in. This is why guru keeps us always at a certain distance. And especially in the diksha relationship, there's usually not much room for friendship there. Shiksha relationship is different. There's a little bit more room for friendship there. But diksha relationship is very much awe and reverence, because it is such a serious relationship. And because as soon as guru allows a little bit of the mood of friendship there, very easily that over familiarity creeps in. And that's the end, you know. So that's why guru keeps us at a healthy distance, you know, just in order to make sure, in order to help us ultimately to have that respectful and reverential mood. So, and in the same way, even in our service, not only can we become over familiar with the devotees we are dealing, but also with the service, and definitely in the puja service, very easily pujaris become very over familiar with the deities, with their activity of worshipping the Lord. And then very easily you commit some offense, and Krishna kicks you out of the deity room, you know. Very, very easily. So that's why also in the service of puja, that awe and reverential mood, very important to always maintain that and not allow any kind of over familiarity and disrespect enter the service mood and the service attitude. So in that way, very important to understand that for real intimacy, that respect and awe and reverence is necessary. So, and in one sense we can make some little efforts in that, in our way of how we deal with the devotees. In that's why ultimately Vaishnava etiquette is there, in order to help us cultivate this more respectful mood. So one very simple way of trying to cultivate the respectful mood is that we always call each other Prabhu or Madhuji, that we don't just say the name. This is also something, you know, in the Western world, in ISKCON, very common. Devotees just call each other by name. I hear it all the time, you know. And every time I hear it, it actually gives me like a little bit of a pain, you know, a little bit of a stabbing in the heart there. Ooh, you know, it sounds really bad, actually, you know, because I'm just so used to it from Bangladesh, from Ukraine. People always call each other with Prabhu. Even the Bhaktas amongst each other, they call each other, you know, whatever might be the name. I mean, and of course in Bangladesh they often have, you know, transcendental names already, you know, even their so-called Kami name is usually a spiritual Hindu name. But they always call each other, you know, Prabhu at the end. So it's Adrian Prabhu, Andrew Prabhu, not just Andrew, Adrian, like this, you know. Horrible, terrible. So in that way, when we address each other as Prabhu, we remember our position. Yes, we are servant, he is Prabhu, he is master. And we should have that attitude to any devotee, not only the senior devotees, also to younger devotees, to bhaktas. We are also the servant. Yeah. So by putting that Prabhu there, we remind ourselves of that, and it creates a little bit of a more respectful atmosphere. And the same amongst the women too. Of course, amongst the ladies, there's always that question. So, you know, some ladies say we should call each other also Prabhu, because we also see each other as master. So, yes, this is also very nice. In a lot of temples, they call each other always Prabhu, not just the name. But then others, like for example in Ukraine and in Bangladesh, they call each other Mataji. They think Prabhu is a little strange, you know. So, and actually for quite some time I was a little struggling with this and thinking, well, how am I supposed to address these ladies, you know? On one hand, if I call them Prabhu, they will look at me funny and think this is strange, you know, in Ukraine or in Bangladesh. And if I call them Mataji, maybe it's a little, you know, artificial for me to call a young girl Mataji, because she's not really, I cannot see her really as my mother or something. But then now recently I had this realization. I thought, no, Mataji is actually the appropriate thing, because it will help us women to behave like mothers. Because this is really also one thing in the Western world. The women, they don't know how to behave like mothers. Yeah. It's out there in the Kami society as well, that the women are always competing with the men. They want to behave like men, and they think this is how we can be happy if we are like men. You know, they don't realize that the female body, the female vehicle, has different qualities and different propensities. And actually, you know, we're supposed to be like the nurturing mothers behind the men. And this is something, you know, very difficult for some women to understand. I mean, a couple of years ago, I did this bold attempt. I was trying to give a little seminar in Mayapur for the women about this. And, oh my God, you know, it was so hard for them to just accept the basic things of Vaishnava etiquette and culture. Vedic culture, Vaishnava culture. They just, you know, they just couldn't accept it. So, and just recently I had this realization, yes, actually for us women it is nice to call each other Mataji. It will help us, it will remind us of our position of being a nurturing mother, being the great wife or mother behind the man. This is what the position of the woman is in society. You know, and by calling each other mother, we don't mean necessarily the physical mother, but that motherly position. So, and in that way, it's no problem for an older devotee to address a young girl as Mataji, because she should also have that motherly nurturing attitude and position. So, in that way, it actually helps us to become a little bit more cultured, and also to build that more respectful and reverential mood in our relationships. In fact, yesterday I asked Sarva Mangala Mataji, when she makes the announcements, you know, or call on line one, you know, or whatever, I said to her, please, you start, you know, adding this culture here, you know, by putting always Prabhu and Mataji behind it. Don't just say, there is a call on line one for, you know, whoever, you know, Kalimbika. But no, Kalimbika Mataji, you know, and Aniruddha Prabhu, or Krishnagaja Prabhu, not just the name. So over familiar. You know, and I was saying to her, maybe, you know, if the devotees hear this always through the sound system, through the intercom system, maybe it will do something to their to their minds, you know. So I thought I'd just mention it to you, just in case you're wondering why she's always adding now this Mataji and this Prabhu, you know. Because also I heard from some devotees that actually some ladies, they were complaining, don't call me Mataji, just call me by the name. But this is because we don't know the culture. We don't know what it means to be respectful. We think this is just some formality. And it is formality because we don't have that true respect in the heart. That's why whenever we try and be respectful, it's simply just a formality for us because we don't have it in the heart. That's the point. We simply try to make some show. And we don't even desire of wanting to become respectful to each other, you know. So that's why we think respect is always a formality and no need for it, because we don't know what it is. But if we want to have intimate relationships, we have to put that as the basis. Otherwise, it will not be real intimacy. That's the point, you know. It will simply be over familiarity. And certainly, if we want to ever serve the Lord in real intimacy, we have to create that respectful mood as well. And how can we have that respectful mood towards the Lord or towards Guru if we don't have it amongst devotees? We have to practice amongst the devotees in our relationships with the devotees to create that respectful mood. And only then we will actually truly also be able to be respectful towards Guru and Krishna. So in that way, absolutely, absolutely necessary. So, time is going up. Yeah, so, and as we know, of course, these dealings described in this verse here between the queens and Krishna, they are not ordinary. We have pointed that out in many previous lectures. They are not ordinary. Very easily we think we mistake them for ordinary dealings between man and woman in this material world. Prabhupada is giving that example, you know, in regards to illustrating how traumatized the human being actually is in this material world with lust. And he's giving that example of a cow who has experienced a fire in the cowshed. So if there is a big fire in the cowshed, it is all red, the red flames. And the cow who is experiencing that and survives the fire, whenever the cow sees some red, she thinks of that fire and she's panicking because of this traumatic experience. And Prabhupada is giving that little analogy in one of his lectures on Radhasthami. And he's saying this is the position of the living entity in the material world. Every time a living entity sees some intimate pastime between Radha and Krishna, or the queens and Krishna, he thinks of lust. He thinks of that experience which he only or she only has in this material world, some lusty exchange. And it's like the cow, you know, seeing the red color and just thinking of the fire in the cowshed. So, and that's why Prabhupada says, actually, especially in a more neophyte stage, one should not too deeply delve, and especially not jump up to these more intimate dealings before we have studied the whole other nine cantos of the Bhagavatam, because this is a very common thing that, you know, people immediately they want to hear those intimate pastimes and so on. And Prabhupada again and again he says, now we have to study first the first nine cantos, and then hopefully we will have some little qualification to hear about those pastimes. So, and there is also one very nice purport where Prabhupada actually describes the purifying effect of hearing those pastimes. That is in 10th canto, 33rd chapter, so that is quite a while ago. Well, it wouldn't be Prabhupada actually, it would be Prabhupada's servants who are describing that. So there's one purport where it says, Qualitatively, the Lord's spiritual loving pastimes are the diametric opposite of material lusty affairs. So much so that simply by hearing about the Lord's pastimes a devotee conquers sex desire. By reading pornographic literature or hearing about material romance, we certainly do not conquer sex desire, but rather increase our lust. But hearing or reading about the Lord's conjugal affairs has exactly the opposite effect, because they are of the opposite nature, being purely spiritual. Therefore, it is by the causeless mercy of the Lord that he exhibits his rasa-lila within this world. If we become attached to this narration, we will experience the bliss of spiritual love and thus reject the perverted reflection of that love which is called lust. So very nicely described, especially when I was first time reading. Therefore, it is by the causeless mercy of Lord Krishna that he exhibits his rasa-lila within this world. It really clicked, you know, and I was really thinking, yes, actually, because especially in Kali Yuga, everybody is so contaminated by lust. This is why it is Krishna's causeless mercy that he's coming to this material world. He's exhibiting rasa-lila just to give us a chance for purification, so that we actually develop some attraction for this pure love, completely transcendental pure love, and that in that way we, at the same time, we lose taste, we reject the perverted reflection of what we have in this material world, which we call love, but it is only lust. So very nicely described that this is Krishna's special mercy. Otherwise, you know, of course there's other purifying factors there as well, except hearing rasa-lila. But because people are so attracted to this mundane lust, by Krishna performing, you know, the real thing, for it is really special mercy, because then we get some chance to actually get some glimpse of the real uncontaminated love. If he wouldn't do that, if he wouldn't have these dealings, then we would really miss out on some chance for purification and for getting a deeper realization of what kind of nature that pure loving relationship between Krishna and his queens and Krishna and the gopis might be. Of course, you know, in our neophyte stage, our understanding is still very, very limited. But at least we have some chance by hearing about the exchanges and so on. So in that way, it is really Krishna's very special causeless mercy that he is exhibiting for us these pastimes, and we can read about them and we can discuss them. So then another point is that yesterday Krishnagaja Prabhu was discussing the Krishna's quality of renunciation, of being renounced. And he was mentioning one little point of which seems like a contradiction, that Krishna at the same time, he is also dependent on his devotee. Even though he is completely self-satisfied and complete within himself and completely renounced, but at the same time, he's also dependent on his devotee. And I want to take that point up and elaborate a little bit more, because I've collected a few nice things above and purports about this point of Krishna being dependent and in actuality allowing himself to be dependent. So there was one, let me see where it is. There's one purport where it is described in regards to preaching. Yes. That's in the ninth canto, Prabhupada is saying, the Krishna consciousness movement is an attempt to increase the number of pure devotees of the Supreme Lord more and more. It is certain that a devotee who helps in this endeavor to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead becomes indirectly a controller of the Supreme Lord. Although the Supreme Lord is full in six opulences, he does not feel transcendental bliss without his devotees. The science of transcendental bliss is known to the pure devotee. Therefore, the pure devotee is always engaged in increasing the transcendental happiness of the Lord. So very nice purport, you know, where it is that the activity of preaching is described as increasing the Lord's bliss, because the preacher gets more and more living entities back home, back to Godhead, and the more devotees Krishna has around him, the more it increases his bliss. So Prabhupada is saying, yes, the pure devotee, he knows that science of how to increase the Lord's bliss, and that's why he is preaching. And in that way, he becomes directly the controller of the Lord. Because, you know, he is the one who gives more and more transcendental pleasure to him by bringing more and more conditioned souls back home, back to Godhead. So then there's a few nice other purports which I have collected in regards to, which describe this dependence which the Lord is allowing. There's one in the sixth canto. Sometimes the Lord requests his devotee to preach his glories all over the world, although he alone is quite competent to perform this task. He could do it all very nicely by himself, right? But he's requesting the devotee to preach. Even though the Supreme Personality of Godhead is endowed with all possessions and is self-sufficient, he depends on his devotee. Therefore, the relationship of the Lord with his devotees is extremely confidential. Only the devotee can perceive how the Lord, although full in himself, depends on his devotee for some particular work. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was quite competent enough to spread his name and mission all over the world, but still he depended upon his devotee to do this work, namely Srila Prabhupada. Considering all these points, the most important aspect of the Supreme Lord's self-sufficiency is that he depends on his devotee. So this sounds really contradictory, doesn't it? It says, considering all these points, the most important aspect of the Supreme Lord's self-sufficiency, which means that he doesn't need anybody, is that he depends on his devotee. This is called his causeless mercy. There we are. This dependence he is allowing as causeless mercy. The devotee who has perceived this causeless mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead by realization can understand the master and the servant. So a very interesting point, very deep actually, you know, that Krishna, although being really the absolute supreme master, completely self-sufficient and independent and full in all opulences, but still, because he is a causelessly merciful master, he allows himself to be dependent on his devotee. And that dependence adds a very sweet and deep and intimate flavor there in the relationship, you see. And naturally, of course, we can understand Krishna wouldn't allow himself to become dependent on anybody. And that's why, you know, he so rarely gives pure devotional service to a devotee, because he knows he puts himself in his control. That's why he gives pure devotional service so rarely, because he doesn't want to, you know, be dependent and controlled by anybody. So that's why it is a very, very special thing, you know. And there was another one. Oh yeah, also in that regard with preaching, you know, there's that little incident where Prabhupada once was asked, why didn't Lord Chaitanya preach all over the world? Why was he only preaching in India? And then Prabhupada was saying, because he left the rest of the world for me. So in that way, sweet and deep intimacy there. And in another purport, there's also another description of this dependency. The Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, if a devotee offers me with devotion a little leaf, a flower, fruit and water, I shall accept it. Why does the Lord say this? Is he dependent on the offering of the devotee? He is not actually dependent, but he likes to be dependent upon his devotee. This is his mercy. Yeah, very nice. And then there's one more. Let me see. Oh no, I read that already. So, yes, and to come to a conclusion, we can say actually that same aspect of dependence is also not only in our relationship with the Lord and the devotees, but also in our relationships amongst the devotees. That actually, you know, it is a certain increased intimacy in a relationship if you allow yourself to be dependent, spiritually dependent on another devotee. So we should not be afraid of this. Very often devotees, they are afraid of being somehow or other dependent on each other. And there's one very nice verse by Jiva Goswami which is mentioned in that book, Taking Care of Krishna's Devotees, which I gave to a few devotees. There's one very nice verse which describes that element of dependency. And it says, though one usually ignores others in attaining one's own goals, in this material world, we usually ignore others, we just want to attain our own goals, those aspiring for prema accept dependence on others with similar goals and tastes. Thus, cooperating with each other, they work together, keeping in mind the goal of prema. It's a very nice verse, very, very nicely capturing that mood. In other words, those aspiring for prema, they allow themselves to be dependent on others with similar goals and similar tastes. So we shouldn't think, you know, we shouldn't think that, yes, we can all achieve it by ourselves. Just me and Krishna and me and Guru, let's endeavor, you know. But no, a devotee accepts shelter and inspiration and guidance and transcendental dependency on those who have the same taste. You know, that's actually what this whole, you know, counselor system is all about. That devotees look for seniors with same tastes and same goals, and they're eager for some shelter, for some inspiration, for some dependency. You see? And that creates a very nice and intimate and sweet relationship. But again, there also has to be the respect and reverence has to be the basis, you know. Otherwise, we will not be able to create that real intimacy and that real dependency. But that is the mood of a devotee. And very often because, as the verse says, one usually ignores others in attaining one's own goals. You know, we kick each other out of the way more or less and we want to get to our goals. So, but in spiritual life, it is not like that. And very easily, because we only have that experience from our life in this material world, that we ignore others in attaining our goals, very easily we bring that same attitude into Krishna consciousness and we also ignore others in our pursuit, you know, of making advancement, you know. But no, devotee has different mood, you know. He's accepting dependence on others with similar goals and tastes, and thus cooperating with each other and working together. They keep in mind the goal of prema. Yeah, very nice description. All right, so I'll finish there. Maybe somebody has some comments, some questions.